Chapter 4. The Heroic Ideal in Buddhism. Although very few people in the West have so far had the opportunity to study or practice Buddhism to any great depth, most of us will have formed some sort of impression of it. We will have formed, too, some sort of impression of the Buddha. We meet people, or we hear of people, who have espoused Buddhism. We read articles about Buddhism in the newspapers. We hear people talking on the radio or the television about Buddhism. We may even, if we go to the cinema, see film stars impersonating the Buddha. Some of these impressions may be quite positive, even in some degree accurate, but inevitably there'll be others which are very misleading, and once established, misconceptions are notoriously difficult to eradicate. The most persistent misconceptions derive, in fact, from the earliest Western interpreters of Buddhism, who naturally saw it from the standpoint of their own religious tradition, a Victorian version of Christianity. It was natural enough for this first wave of Western literature on Buddhism to explain it to largely Christian readers by making use of Christian concepts. But the misconceptions they generated have stood up remarkably robustly to the passage of time. One of them, for example, was the idea that Buddhism was not a religion in the full sense of the word. According to this view, it could be regarded as an impressive system of philosophy like that of Plato, or Kant, or Hegel, or an admirable scheme of ethics, or even a system, a remarkable system, of mysticism, but as no more really than that. Roman Catholic scholars in particular, for some reason or other, Roman Catholics have always tended to make it a bit of a speciality of Buddhism, damned it with faint praise in this way, and somehow suggested that there was a whole dimension missing in Buddhism which was supplied in full within Christianity. Another equally tenacious misconception was that Buddhism was a specifically Oriental religion, that it was inextricably tied up with various Oriental cultures. This is evidently quite a difficult one to see through, because even today there does not seem to be a great deal of enthusiasm for the idea of distinguishing the essence of Buddhism from its cultural expression, exotic, colourful and attractive as these expressions invariably are. But if the practice of the Buddhist path is really to be established in the West, we will have to find ways of integrating the Dharma with our own more humdrum, grey and familiar culture. The particular misconception to which this chapter is addressed originated in the Victorian perception of the Buddha himself. They tended, again naturally enough, to see him as a sort of Oriental Jesus, and the popular Victorian conception of Jesus was a rather milk-and-water version of the real thing. It has been said that for the Victorians, Christ was a ghostly figure in a white sheet, gliding around Galilee and gently rebuking people for not believing in the Nicene Creed. So a Victorian Buddha was likewise installed in the popular imagination as a ghostly figure in a yellow sheet, gliding around India and gently rebuking people for not being kind to animals. In this way, Buddhism began to be perceived as a rather passive, negative, or gutless teaching and tradition. This impression, unfortunately, can only be reinforced, perhaps unconsciously, by any acquaintance one may have with later Buddhist art, in which decadent phase the Buddha is depicted as a sweet, dreamy, effeminate figure. As for the mass-produced representations of the Buddha that are turned out in India today, usually on calendars, their attempts at the smile of enlightenment leave the Buddha with a coquettish simper of a sentimental starlet. Such images cannot but influence the way we see the Buddha in our own minds. Another factor which we have to take into account is that Buddhism is a religion of Indian provenance. While Indian culture is respected for its spirituality, It is also looked upon as backward, slow, unprogressive, and unenterprising. And therefore epithets of this sort seem naturally to attach themselves to Buddhism when it is considered as an Indian religion. We also have to recognize that a good deal of contemporary Buddhist teaching in the East, particularly from Sri Lanka, Burma and Thailand, has tended to be rather negative. You are told not to do this and to refrain from that and to abstain from the other. But you are not nearly so often told what you can do to cultivate positive qualities and develop in a positive sense. The oldest Buddhist scriptures recognize that you can't have one side of a coin without the other, and carry a forthright positive emphasis as well as an uncompromising negative one. But the teaching has been too often presented in the West in terms of avoidance rather than engagement, in terms of escape rather than commitment. In order to redress this imbalance, we have to take a fresh look at what Buddhism is about. We have to rethink, perhaps, our whole attitude to the spiritual life. The aim of Buddhist teaching is the attainment of enlightenment or Buddhahood, a state of moral and spiritual perfection. And this ideal calls for the exercise, on the moral and spiritual plane, of heroic qualities. When we speak of the heroic ideal in Buddhism, we are not speaking of anything distinct from, much less still opposed to, the spiritual ideal. We are speaking of the spiritual ideal itself, an ideal that requires heroism in the highest degree. We are not out of the woods yet, however. It is all very well to suggest that the spiritual ideal is not just a goody-two-shoes, keep-your-nose-clean ideal, that it is actually a heroic ideal. But how do we really feel about this heroic ideal? Let's face it, the whole concept is unfashionable. The whole notion of having ideals suggests alienation and lack of acceptance, to use the fashionable terminology. As for the hero or heroine, he or she is tainted by a suggestion of nobility, of a kind of real superiority in his or her makeup, that is somehow objectionable to modern taste. 100 years ago it was quite different. Victorians flaunted their high ideals with an assurance that seems unthinkable today, and the heroic ideal was all the rage. Such was the Victorian taste for hero worship that almost anyone who had risen to some eminence in public life might be revered, even worshipped as a hero. It was for this reason, perhaps, that the person representing their highest spiritual ideals, Jesus, should have been so ethereal a figure, to distinguish him from the more mundane objects of public adoration. Thomas Carlyle's lectures, Heroes and Hero Worship, first published in 1841, established as axiomatic the view that history is the biography of great men. Thackeray was able to label his novel Vanity Fair as unique among the mass of fiction being run off the presses at the time, 1848, by subtitling it A Novel Without a Hero. On the mantelpiece in any home in the country, you would find china figurines of highly esteemed public figures. Alfred Lord Tennyson, Florence Nightingale, Gordon of Khartoum, Gladstone and Disraeli were admired as pop stars are today. And no sooner were they dead than out came at least 3 and sometimes 6 or 7 thick, one might say monumental, volumes of memoirs and letters. Victorian biographies were exercises in hagiography. They were intended to exhibit the great man in all his glory, striking the pose or attitude in which everybody wanted to remember him. This is why the great Victorians appear, even in retrospect, so very much larger than life. The First World War was sold to the man in the street as an opportunity to be heroic himself, and it was probably the association of the heroic pose with incompetent generals and mass slaughter that rather did for the heroic ideal. Biographies became exercises in debunking in showing how petty and ordinary so-called great men really were. The classic example of this new type of biography was Lytton Strachey's Eminent Victorians, 1918, in which no fewer than four great Victorians suffered the indignity of being packed together in one slim volume. The Victorians themselves would have regarded this as shocking, almost indecent, like burying four people in one grave. Today, heroes and heroines may still be found in the more commercial works of fiction, in a debased and perverted form, but rarely elsewhere, and certainly not in politics. When you recall that people used to write to Gladstone or Disraeli asking for a lock of their hair to wear in a locket round the neck, you have to admit that times have changed. It would be difficult to find someone involved in determining the important public issues of our day who might be regarded in quite this adulatory light. No doubt this is as it should be. Victorian hero worship was certainly a bad case of projection, and their ideals can sometimes look like hypocrisy. No man is a hero to his own valet, we observe sagely. However, if we replace ideals with cynicism, we deny the possibility of change. And if we take a valet's eye view of the hero, if the whole idea of the hero seems to us a little ridiculous and absurd, if we refuse to look up to someone of exceptional qualities, we deny reality as surely as the Victorians did. It means we cannot take seriously someone of extraordinary ability who has ideals, that is to say, someone who is serious and cares deeply about something important. I have introduced the concept of the hero at some length, because although it is an unfashionable word in English, it translates, more accurately than any less challenging term does, one of the titles by which Siddhartha Gautama was known after his enlightenment. We know him as the Buddha, or sometimes the Compassionate One, but the Pali and Sanskrit texts also apply to the Buddha the epithets Mahavira, which means great hero, and Jinna, which means conqueror. In fact, the title Jinna is almost as common in the earliest Buddhist texts as the one we are so familiar with, the Buddha. He is the conqueror, because he has conquered the whole of conditioned existence within himself. He has conquered the world by conquering himself. According to the Dhammapada, though one may conquer in battle 1,000 men 1,000 times, yet he who conquers himself has the more glorious victory. Later, medieval Buddhism produced the idea of the Trilokya Vijaya, the conquest of the three worlds, conquest, that is, of the world of sensuous desire, the world of archetypal form, and the world of no form. So the Jinna's victory is over these three inner worlds. By virtue of this conquest, the Buddha becomes, of course, a king. Having subdued all the realms of conditioned existence within his own mind, he is called the Dharma Raja, king of the law, or king of truth. It is as a king that the Buddha is often portrayed in Buddhist art. We know this because he's shown bearing the insignia of royalty. These insignia are actually quite curious, at least to Westerners. In England, the corresponding insignia are, of course, the orb and sceptre, the symbols of the reigning monarch's authority. But in India, and wherever the Buddhist cultural tradition has penetrated, they comprise instead the parasol and fly whisk. In India in the Buddha's day, an ordinary person never used a parasol or umbrella. You certainly didn't use one for keeping off the weather. You would probably have used a leaf. A real umbrella could only be used by the king or some other noble and eminent person. According to Lama Govinda, this goes back to when the elder of the tribal village used to sit under a tree in the evening with his back against the trunk, dispensing advice and settling disputes. The umbrella became, if we accept this interpretation, a sort of artificial tree held above you as you went about, as a symbol of your social position. Following this line of thought, we can link this symbolic umbrella ultimately with the cosmic tree, which in mystical terms overshadows the whole world, the whole of existence. The fly whisk is a more straightforward symbol. It is made from the tail of the yak, a plume of very soft white hair, about 2 feet long, and very beautiful. The tail is mounted on a silver handle, and royal personages are gently fanned with it to keep off the flies. It is still used in Hindu ritual worship. There's a stage during the arati, the evening worship, when the fly whisk is waved in front of the image of the deity, Rama or Krishna or whoever it may be, because he's being treated for the time being as a king as well as a god. Therefore, just as Jesus is often represented, seated with the orb and scepter in his hands to signify his divine kingship, so in Buddhist art, the Buddha is depicted with an umbrella held over him, sometimes by divine beings, and with gods flanking him, equipped with fly whisks. These symbols show that he is king of the Dharma, king, if you like, of the spiritual universe. The Buddha being king, his chief disciple, Shariputra, was known as his Dharmasena Pati, which means, and this may be a bit of an eye-opener, commander-in-chief. No, this is not the Salvation Army we are talking about here. It is indeed the Buddhist Sangha of docile repute. This royal symbolism and military terminology are not unconnected, perhaps, with the Buddha's original social background. Being a Kshatriya, he belonged, according to the Hindu reckoning, to the second of the four castes, the Brahmins or priestly caste coming first, in terms of status. But the Kshatriyas didn't see it like that. While the other castes accepted this ordering of the hierarchy, the Kshatriyas regarded themselves as the top caste. This is also the way the castes are arranged whenever they are mentioned in the Pali Canon, with the Kshatriyas first. So in the early Buddhist texts, the warrior is given preeminence, from a purely social point of view, over the priest. We know that when Siddhartha was growing up, Brahmanism had not penetrated into Shakyan territory, so we can be fairly sure that he was educated purely and simply as a warrior, and a warrior in a sense he remained. There's a legend that when he became betrothed to Yashodhara, some of her kinsmen objected that he wasn't good enough at fighting, and of course he had to prove his worth by defeating them all in contest. Clearly, as a nobleman, it was not enough to be a warrior. He was required to be an exceptional warrior, a hero. It is quite significant that this should have been the background of the person who would become the prime exemplar of the spiritual life. It is significant as well that the heroic qualities he'd been trained to exhibit on the battlefield were drawn upon at every step of his spiritual quest. We know that he left home when he was about 29. He left everything he'd been taught to believe in as the good life. Everything he'd been taught to believe was worthwhile. Everything he'd been taught to believe was his duty. It must have been a great wrench to leave his family and his tribe, to go out alone into the darkness, into the forest, going he knew not where, knowing only that he went in search of truth. But this is what he did. Then for such a man to support himself as a mendicant called for no lesser degree of fortitude. The traditional procedure of the alms round was simple enough, as it still is today. You take a big black begging bowl, and moving from door to door, you stand for a few minutes at each house, and people come out and put a few scraps of food in your bowl. When you feel you've collected enough for your meal, you go off to a quiet spot outside the village and sit down to eat it. Not a demanding way of providing for oneself, you might think, but there is a rather poignant touch in the Buddha's own account of his first alms round, which shows what it can be like when you aren't used to it. What he apparently told his disciples, according that is to the scriptures, but the story has the ring of truth to it anyway, is that the first time he sat down outside a village with his bowl, he took one look at the heap of disparate scraps of food in it and vomited. Having been used to the choicest quality of absolutely fresh food, prepared by the best cooks, he found himself gazing down at the coarse leftovers of peasants, and his stomach turned. But he did not allow his own delicacy to stand in the way of his quest. If the price of his freedom was to subsist on this sort of diet, he had to overcome his disgust, and that is what he did. His clothing was rough and ready too, of course. Going around the modern Buddhist world, you can easily get the impression that the Buddha went around in brand new, beautifully laundered, clean and neat yellow robes, but this seems highly unlikely. He almost certainly wore rough yellow garments, stained and ragged. It's a sad fact that nowadays, in some Buddhist countries, a monk who goes around in a rather old robe is considered a bit of a disgrace. I myself remember coming down to a monastery in Calcutta from Kalimpong one time, and, I have to say, I did not think to dress up for the occasion, but some of my monk friends were quite scandalized because I happened to be wearing a very old robe. To them it was terrible. "What will people think?" they said. We have to imagine that the Buddha himself would have had a completely different sartorial attitude. For him, what he wore would have represented a complete break from his previous way of life, in which his secure social position was clearly reflected in the way he dressed. Having gone forth, Siddhartha quickly mastered the teachings that were made available to him, and yet he did not rest on his laurels, but took his way alone again, and no man to guide him. In his old age, he used to reminisce about this critical period in his life. He described how he would be in the depths of the jungle at night, when everything was dark and silent, with no one for miles around, and he would hear a twig break or a leaf fall, and a terrible panic, fear, and dread would come over him. Those who've practiced meditation know that this can happen sometimes. Fear just wells up. It isn't that there's anything objective to be afraid of, particularly, and there seems to be very little you can do about it. But this is what Siddhartha used to experience. He would be seized with a nameless terror. So, how to subdue this fear and dread? What did he do to break its hold? What, in fact, he realized was that he had to do literally nothing. He said, "If the fear came while I was walking up and down, I continued walking up and down. If it came while I was sitting, I continued sitting. If while I was standing it came, then I continued standing. And if I was lying down when it came, well, I continued lying down. The fear would pass away as it had arisen." In other words, he didn't try to escape it. He let it come, he let it stay there, and he let it go away. He did not suffer his mind, his essential mind, to be disturbed by it. Though Siddhartha took on every difficulty and adversity that lay in his way, these provided, so far, relatively minor hardships. It is a measure of his essentially heroic character, however, that he then chose to take upon himself the most arduous spiritual path he could find. Not only this, but having taken up the practice of austerities, he followed that path more rigorously than any man alive at the time. He was experimenting, searching for the truth by trial and error, and when he tried something, he followed that method to the limits of his human capacity. So he went about naked, even in the bitter winters of the Himalayan foothills, with snow lying thick on the ground. He stopped using a bowl and just took what little food he ate in his hands. He had heard it said that if you cut down your food to a few grains of rice or barley and a little water, this would bring you to the brink of enlightenment. So he did this. There's a terrible description in the scriptures of the emaciated state this regime brought him to, and it is the subject of a famous Gandharan stone carving, which portrays Siddhartha at this stage in his career as a seated figure consisting of no more than skin and bone and tendons. It may be difficult for us to admire this sort of endeavour. It probably seems to us simply perverse. But you have to remember that he was doing it with a very clear purpose in mind, and that the consensus at that time favoured the practice of austerities as highly efficacious if you had the heart for it. Even today in India, people are very much impressed by austerities. A friend of mine who was a monk at Sarnath told me once about a visit they had there from a celebrated ascetic. His disciples impressed upon the monks that their master only ate a certain kind of grain in the morning, and that it had to be ready on the dot of 7 o'clock. It seemed such an important point that my friend, who was the assistant abbot at Sarnath, took responsibility for seeing that their guest had what he needed. So in the morning he carried this grain to the great ascetic's room just a little before 7 o'clock to make sure he got it in time, only to find that he'd already gone. There were still a couple of his disciples lingering about, so my friend asked them for an explanation. "Here it is, what he wanted, just when he wanted it, and he hasn't even waited for it." The disciples replied, "Ah, that's his greatness." I'm afraid my friend told them quite politely what their teacher could do with his greatness, and as you can imagine, this did not go down well. But this sort of eccentricity can attract a great deal of attention in India. Even in the West, in some religious circles, eccentricity can earn you quite a little following. So for Siddhartha to give all this up, to give up other people's expectations of him, to go back once again to being a nobody, required psychological and spiritual courage of a high and heroic order. It is so much easier to do anything, however difficult in itself, when you've got other people around, idolizing and applauding you, saying, "Look at him, how heroic he is." But when no one likes what you are doing, and your admirers flounce off in disgust, that is a very testing time, and there are very, very few people who can handle it. Jesus, you might say, had something of this experience in the Garden of Gethsemane. Finally, having realized for himself what the true path was, that it led through the stages of meditation, Siddhartha fixed his resolve on the goal with an unshakable resolution. At this point, a beautiful and dramatic verse is put into his mouth by some early compilers of the scriptures. "Let blood dry up, let flesh wither away, but I shall not stir from this spot till enlightenment be attained." He did not say, "Well, I'll give this a go for a few days, and if it doesn't work, I'll just have to try something else, I suppose." His commitment, once he had seen the way clear before him, was total and uncompromising. Nothing less would do for the purpose he had set himself, which was to overturn conditioned existence itself. The Buddha's enlightenment is therefore very often described in simple heroic terms as a victory. A victory over Mara, the Buddhist embodiment of evil. The name Mara means death, literally, and he personifies all the forces of evil existing within our own mind, our negative emotions, our psychological conditionings, and so on. Everything that binds us to repeated suffering. In short, our craving, our hatred, and our ignorance. But on account of his victory over Mara, another of the Buddha's titles is Marajit, the conqueror of Mara. Given that the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment was so conspicuously the expression, the ultimate expression, of the heroic ideal, it is no surprise to find that his teaching puts such a stress on self-reliance, on not relying even on him. There is a famous exhortation from the Buddha that appears a number of times in the Pali scriptures. "All that a teacher could do have I done for you. Here are the roots of trees. Sit down. Meditate. The rest is up to you." He was always on at the monks, asking them what they were up to, how they were getting on, never letting them slacken off, always arousing them, inspiring them to greater efforts. And they responded, most of them. Others got a bit tired of it all and jibbed at the pace at which the Buddha was driving them. But they soon left to find an easier teacher. The Buddha knew from personal experience that it was no easy matter. On more than one occasion, he spoke of the spiritual life in terms of a battle and addressed the monks in martial strain. "We are Kshatriyas, warriors," he told them. And he did not mean that they were of the Kshatriya caste, because his disciples were from every caste, from Brahmins to untouchables, and no distinction of caste was respected in the Sangha. He said, "We are warriors because we are fighters. And what do we fight for? We fight for Shila, the ethical life. We fight for Samadhi, higher consciousness. We fight for Prajna, wisdom. And we fight for Vimukti, complete spiritual emancipation." In passages like this, the Buddha comes across as the embodiment of fearlessness and self-confidence. There is no false humility or bravado about him. His utterance is spoken of as his sinhanada, his lion's roar. We all know people who bleat like sheep, even people who bark like little woolly lambs, and we know people who bark or yap like dogs. But the Buddha's preaching is likened to the roaring of a lion, because, according to Indian mythology, when the lion roars, every other beast in the jungle falls silent. When the Buddha expounds the truth, no one can stand against it. You don't have to cast your net very wide to find the heroic ideal being extolled or put into practice in the Buddhist scriptures. However, for a more direct and immediate impression of the fundamentally heroic nature of the Buddhist ideal, you only have to look at some of the more powerful images in Buddhist art. I'm not thinking here of the Gandharan tradition of sculpture, which is not purely Indian and is sometimes a bit cloying, but of the Mathura tradition, named after a place not very far from where Delhi is today, and the earliest purely Indian art, in which is emphasized vigor rather than gentleness, confidence rather than tenderness, strength rather than sweetness. Characteristic of this artistic movement is a standing portrayal of the Buddha as a powerfully built man in the prime of life, firmly erect, like a great tower or a massive tree, and making with his hands the Abhaya Mudra, the gesture of fearlessness. Buddhist art does not, of course, focus solely on the Buddha himself, nor is the heroic ideal embodied solely in the person of the Buddha. From the Mahayana development of Buddhism emerged, as its most important contribution to the Buddhist vision, the figure of the Bodhisattva. As an archetype, the Bodhisattva became a symbolic manifestation of a particular aspect of enlightenment, and one of the most important and revered of these archetypal Bodhisattvas is Manjushri, who represents wisdom. Just as in the Dhammapada, the Buddha describes the Dharmafarer as destroying the hosts of Mara with the sword of wisdom, so Manjushri is depicted in the form known as Arapachana Manjushri, as brandishing aloft in his right hand a flaming sword, the sword of knowledge or wisdom. Later still in the historical development of Buddhism, the central figure of Tantric Buddhism is the figure of the wrathful Vajrapani, who represents, in his graphically fearsome aspect, the heroic, fearless energy of the enlightened mind. In his right hand he brandishes a Vajra, an indestructible weapon of irresistible power. The Bodhisattva ideal, the determination to guide all sentient beings to nirvana, is the epitome of the heroic ideal as exemplified in the Buddha's own life. In the Mahayana literature, the Bodhisattva is likened to the new moon. As the new moon is to the full moon, so the Bodhisattva is to the Buddha. As the new moon waxes to full moon, so the Bodhisattva grows towards Buddhahood. And he or she does this by the practice of the six paramitas, the six transcendental virtues of giving, ethics, patience, energy, meditative concentration, and wisdom. These virtues are all to be practiced, according to the Mahayana texts, on a truly heroic scale. It's not just a matter of an occasional burst of generosity, a momentary awareness of the ethical dimension in one's choice of action, a reasonable degree of patience, a fitful stirring of spiritual energy, a modicum of meditative absorption once or twice a week, and the odd moment of reflection and contemplation on the Dharma. Take giving, for instance. The Bodhisattva gives not just material things, but even life and limb if necessary. It is against this sort of background that we can understand the self-immolation of Vietnamese monks who wanted to draw attention to the terrible spiritual plight of their country. And the Bodhisattva practices all the virtues or perfections not just during one lifetime, but, according to the heroic vision of Mahayana Buddhism, over an enormous number of lives, spanning three kalpas or aeons. The Bodhisattva's hero is delineated particularly clearly in a passage from the Ashta Sahasrika, the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines. As usual in the Pranyaparamita Sutras, the Buddha is addressing his disciple Subhuti. Suppose, Subhuti, that there were a most excellent hero, very vigorous, of high social position, handsome, possessing all the finest virtues, of those virtues which spring from the very height of sovereignty, morality, learning, renunciation, and so on. He is judicious, able to express himself, to formulate his views clearly, to substantiate his claims. One who always knows the suitable time, place, and situation for everything. In archery, he has gone as far as one can go. He is successful in warding off all manner of attack, most skilled in all arts, and foremost in all crafts. He is versed in all the treatises, has many friends, is wealthy, well-knit, stout of limb, with all his faculties complete. Generous to all, dear and pleasant to men. Any work he might undertake he manages to complete. He speaks methodically, shares his great riches with the many, honours what should be honoured, reveres what should be revered, worships what should be worshipped. Would such a person, Subhuti, feel ever-increasing joy and zest? Subhuti, he would, O Lord. The Lord. Now suppose further that this person, so greatly accomplished, should have taken his family with him on a journey, his mother and father, his sons and daughters. By some circumstance they find themselves in a great wild forest. The foolish ones among them would feel hair-raising dread. He, however, would fearlessly say to his family, "Do not be afraid. I shall soon take you safely and securely out of this terrible and frightful forest. I shall soon set you free." If, then, more and more hostile and inimical forces should rise up against him in that forest, would this heroic man decide to abandon his family and take himself alone out of that terrible and frightening forest? He who is not one to draw back, who is endowed with all the power deriving from firmness and vigour, who is wise, exceedingly tender and compassionate, courageous, and a master of many resources? Subhuti, no, O Lord, for that person who does not abandon his family has at his disposal powerful resources, both within and without. On his side, forces will arise in that wild forest, which are quite a match for the hostile and inimical forces. They will stand up for him and protect him. Those enemies and adversaries of his who look for a weak spot will not gain any hold over him. He is competent to master the situation and is able, unhurt and uninjured, soon to take out of that forest both his family and himself, and securely and safely will they reach a village, city, or market town. The Lord, just so, Subhuti, is it with a Bodhisattva, who is full of pity and concern for the welfare of all beings, who dwells in friendliness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and even-mindedness. This, then, is an account from the Pranayaparamita tradition of the Bodhisattva as hero, leading all sentient beings out of the deep forests of samsara to the city of enlightenment. If we turn to other traditions, Zen or Tantric Buddhism, we could produce many other examples of the heroic ideal in Buddhism. But perhaps enough has been said to dismiss the notion of Buddhism as a disengaged, bloodless or effete teaching and tradition. We may say, on the contrary, that it asserts the heroic ideal to a degree that ought to render it quite unfashionable. And as Buddhists, we should be prepared to question fashionable ideas and attitudes. To a Buddhist, it must seem a pity that the heroic ideal has been discredited or degraded in our century, because people really need something to live for, and if necessary to die for. So fundamental indeed is it to Buddhism that we may say that the heroic ideal is conterminous with the spiritual life itself. Heroism is intrinsic to the quest for enlightenment, and it therefore runs to the very core of the essential nature of the Buddha.